In other news.
To determine why and how the towers collapsed.
Kind of scary to have this helicopter hovering around.
We walk up to him and confront him. They can't stand that.
Welcome to Another News. I'm Jeff Brady. In another gang stalking case, we explore the levels of covert harassment and stalking designed to isolate the person from their friends and family and slowly deteriorate their quality of life. Is it hard to believe any of this could really be happening to people? That it's likely an undiagnosed psychological condition? As past guest Lori Handrahan has revealed, the epidemic of child sex abuse amid law enforcement, military, medical, and educational institutions, there's a silent epidemic of covert harassment and microwave attacks also occurring. Keep in mind, we live amid a massive build-out of microwave antennas, and now billions are allocated for 5G antenna build-outs. In some of the covert stalking cases examined, you may have noticed how the guest is empathic and born with a unique communication with the natural world. Susan Conley is no exception. She's endured years of harassment, including constant attacks using microwave frequency. Her jewelry and nice clothes have been stolen. Food and drink has surreptitiously been removed from her fridge, and she's constantly fatigued, likely from being drugged or poisoned. The incessant stalking and bizarre tactics can be traced back several years ago when Susan ended a potentially abusive relationship. Susan joins us to talk more about her case as we get another glimpse into a permanently altered life marred by isolation, physical illness, and covert psychotronic attacks. Susan, welcome to Another News.
Thank you.
I appreciate you being on the show to share your story. It's important to emphasize that being the subject of various types of harassment nearly 24 hours a day will wear a person down physically and psychologically. And this level of trauma and deterioration will give the appearance of maybe paranoid delusion and make it difficult for you to get people interested in your case. And as you know, on the show, there have been a number of stalking cases examined, and I appreciate that you have the courage to make your story public.
Thank you so much, Jeff.
Well, if you would please tell listeners about yourself and describe your life when you were not experiencing harassment and attacks to then what you suspect set things off.
I'm 52 and or 53, just turned 53 in December, born and raised in Minnesota. And at the age of 21, I knew I wanted to escape the frozen tundra, so to speak. It's just too bleak and cold there for too long. And I've lived in California for a number of years, as well as Arizona, Colorado, North Carolina, and a little bit in Dallas. I've always been very independent and adventurous, so to speak, able to go out on my own and make new friends. And I never really had that homesick feeling. So I've always been, you know, pretty self-confident and took care of myself and worked full-time in property management, and then later on for the past 15 years in telecommunications. I have a love of nature, animals. I grew up on a lake, so I love to swim. I love to go hiking. I had a horse for many years. I love to go horseback riding. So I was, you know, pretty fearless. I've also volunteered at a wildlife rescue place with coyotes, wolves, bears, lions, and all that. And I just don't have any fear. And I've also taken very good care of myself, eat very well. I exercise for many, many years, weight-bearing exercises, as well as high-impact cardio. I could do very high cardio for 60 minutes straight without really feeling it too much. I thrived on that. So when I began to feel very, very fatigued all the time and just not thinking as clear and as quick as I usually would, I began to be very afraid. This probably started happening about 5 years ago. When I lived in Arizona, I was just all of a sudden waking up so incredibly tired, even though I had gotten a full night's sleep and everything. And it was extremely difficult for me to carry out the workday and, you know, do whatever errands or activities I needed to do after working. And I just went from doctor to doctor, different specialists, trying to figure out why I felt so horrible. I mean, first it was the fatigue, horrendous digestive issues, then most of my hair fell out, and no one could really explain it. So it probably, I didn't notice, you know, all this illness until about 5 years ago, and since then it's been pretty much downhill.
You met your fiancé in Dallas, and what were indicators for you that things weren't right?
He moved very quickly. I was living in California at the time, and he was in Dallas. I met him, you know, through an online dating site, a vetted one. Then he had wanted me to move to Dallas within a month, had purchased an engagement ring within 2 months. I had briefly looked at one online, and all of a sudden it was being mailed to me. So those were early indicators that something was not quite right. Unfortunately, I didn't trust my gut, so to speak, and I did relocate to Dallas, and from there things got much worse. I noticed he had a very quick temper. I never knew, you know, when he would explode at the slightest thing. He seemed to be very possessive with what he bought me. And then, you know, when we were just fighting terribly and I was pretty much terrified out of my mind, we both decided I should move. I moved back to Arizona in my parents' house for a while. And I always had this feeling that I would never be free, but I've kind of dismissed it. I still wanted to remain on friendly terms because, of course, there were still, you know, good traits about him, and we shared many things in common.
So instinctively or subconsciously, you had a feeling that you wouldn't ever be free from this individual?
Yes. And, you know, it 12 years ago seems like a lifetime, and I don't remember, you know, exactly what may have triggered that thought process or what sequence of events, or maybe it was just an accumulation of small things where I began to be, you know, very concerned. He wouldn't let me relocate my cats to his place. He would not let me ship my vehicle. I had at the time an Audi to Dallas. He purchased a BMW for me. And, you know, things like that just started to raise alarm bells in my head, as well as he didn't really seem to have any friends. He also didn't tell his family about me or the lady he was building a house for. He didn't tell her about me or his ex-wife, and I remember always asking him, why can't you tell anyone about me? So there were just these odd things that occurred that, you know, told my gut something is not right. I needed to move on.
Could you give us a profile of your ex-fiancé?
No, I'm not a psychologist or anything, but I view him now as a, you know, a psychopath, a person very controlling, without feelings. I mean, as a matter of fact, he mentioned to me that the feelings don't serve anyone well. They're pretty much useless to have. They don't get you anywhere. You know, feelings like sadness or hurt or something like that are to your detriment, in his opinion. I remember him wanting gifts back that he had given me, and he didn't want me to ship the boxes, you know, boxes of my personal items, and which I guess included some gifts he had given me. back to Arizona when I was relocating back there from Dallas. So, like I said, I'm not a doctor, but there's something not right with that personality.
Well, what did he do for a living, and what was his skill level, for example?
I term him as a genius. He was a custom home builder, and he also designed homes. I don't believe he held, you know, an architect degree, but he would draw up, you know, architectural plans and design homes from start to finish, you know, everything, the materials, the wood, the electrical, the plumbing, you know, ambient heating under the floors, hidden doors that would slide in and out. And I know this because he showed me a house he built once, you know, a TV that would slide, you know, down into a cabinet at the flick of a switch and then back up again. So he was incredibly talented in many areas, as well as math and science and writing skills. It just, I'm very intuitive and perceptive, and you can tell instantly that he was someone who had a lot of skills and very intelligent, which in turn, I believe, made him very socially awkward without friends, basically.
I guess that's important, especially when we get into covert harassment and somebody with that level of knowledge of the nooks and crannies of a home or a building structure that would make somebody suspicious, I suppose, especially if there was a motive.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
When you moved to Arizona, you were in at least two locations. You rented a home and then an apartment. Would you talk about some of the strange occurrences where your belongings were suddenly missing or misplaced?
Yeah, I had the slightest inclination that, you know, something was off. Actually, when I lived at my parents' house, as well as initially, and then subsequent apartments at my parents' house, you know, maybe if I hung something on the wall face forward, a little trinket, it would be turned backwards, and some medications missing like that. But that was pretty much it. When I moved from my parents' house to a house that I rented from a couple, that's actually when I really became much more sick and started to notice many odd, frightening things. For example, if I went out shopping, I would come home and, oh, say a little statue that was on my end table would suddenly be on my dresser. Or I could tell some clothes were missing. There were clothes missing from hangers. Or one time a jar of jelly that I had in the refrigerator was on the counter when I came home. So a lot of things would be moved and relocated, and, you know, a couple of minor things were completely gone. And I assumed actually it was the people that I had rented the house from, because they had their main house, you know, on the same property. So I was just pretty much living in fear. I didn't want to accuse them because I didn't know where I would go or move to at that, you know, point. I couldn't immediately move. So, and I remember being incredibly sick sometimes, very dizzy. I would wake up very dizzy. I wouldn't have balance. I would sometimes careen from wall to wall as if, you know, I was intoxicated, but I wasn't. It became more and more difficult for me to leave the house. A few times my car keys would go missing and I literally could not go anywhere. They were one time found in the yard by the lady who lived there. Another time they were found in their barn. And I know for a fact I didn't leave my car keys in the yard or a barn, but you can't prove these things to anyone. And, you know, I would start to tell my family, I need to move. I think these people aren't right. But no one believed me. So I was pretty much stuck there for several months.
This was early on. What are your thoughts on why, say, for example, your parents didn't believe you?
Because it all, I believe it all sounds so absurd. Who would move small objects around someone's dwelling or take small things or, you know, steal food or drinks or leave them out? It just, for an average common sense, so-called normal person, these acts don't make any sense, thus they must not be true, is the mindset I encounter pretty much with every family member and friend I've had, because who would do such a thing? Yet, it's true. That's the evil intent of it all with this organized stalking, is to make the victim appear delusional or perhaps going a little crazy. Because these events are so absurd, your normal stalker, average thief, you know, is going to steal high-priced items or something like that. It's just not known in this country or pretty much anywhere else very well.
Did you alert the authorities at all that there was a potential break-in because somebody clearly was in the home stealing your property?
Yeah, actually one night I did call 911 from that house. You know, I've never felt true fear, true terror in my life until that night. I remember I was shut in another room, actually texting with one of my aunts who lives in Maui. And I remember it was later at night. It was very quiet, maybe 12 p.m., you know, 12 a.m. or 1 a.m. in the morning. And I heard low voices, and then I heard a little giggling. And I remember texting my aunt saying, "Debbie, can you call 911? Someone's in my house," because I didn't want to alert the people. I didn't want the people that were in there that I was hearing giggling and talking, I didn't want them to hear me, and I wanted them to be caught, basically. You know, I didn't want to give them a heads up that the police were being called. She did not. I had asked her to call my dad as well, and that's actually what she did. And neither one did anything. I remember waiting, hiding in this room, and then more giggling, and I finally called 911 myself. And probably about 5 minutes later, I opened the door very slowly because it had gone quiet, and there were these circle of red jasper rocks in my bedroom doorway. And I just remember screaming and then crawling on my knees because, you know, the house was dark. It was late at night, waiting for the police, just terrified. I didn't know if they were still in the house, if they were lurking outside or whatever. And anyway, the police finally came 10 minutes later, and they went to the main house where the couple lived. I came out because they were at the wrong house. And, you know, by then, no one was there. The police didn't even really look around. They were just like, "Well, we don't see anyone. There's no sign of a break-in, so we're going to go." And that was that. There was no help.
Was there evidence somebody might have had a key to your place?
No, not that I know of. There was, the house that I rented, there was actually a second bedroom attached that was not part of my rental agreement. That door was locked, so I didn't have access to it. It was still the use or property of the couple that owned the house, because it had direct access to their, you know, pool and spa. And I believe, that's my theory anyway, they came in that way, and I don't know if they always kept that door locked or not on the outside. And it was just, you know, a simple bedroom door, which I'm sure that lock can be picked pretty easily. But that's just my theory. I can't prove that. But from what I know with these organized stalking groups, picking locks or deadbolts or disabling alarm systems is pretty much nothing to them.
Getting back to the missing items, some of the items that were missing started connecting some dots here, because some of the objects were gifts from your ex-fiancé. Can you talk about that?
Yes. After I lived in that house, it was only for 3 months, I moved to an apartment, and the same kind of issues started happening, actually, before I even physically moved in there. When I was moving things piece by piece, I would go to that apartment and find that things I had moved there, a lot of them were rifled through, items that had been gifts from my ex, be it clothes, shoes, some jewelry, paintings, artwork, anything of that nature were gone. And it took me a couple of years, actually, after moving, to two more subsequent apartments after that first one, to really connect the dots and put the pieces together, because I was always so terrorized and sort of like behind the ball trying to figure out who was behind, you know, following me and stalking me and stealing items and actually sometimes vandalizing or just breaking a little bit or quite literally destroying like a TV or a desk or something like that. And, you know, my ex lives in Houston and has for many, many years, and we had remained in touch via text or whatever and still had horses in common. So it never dawned on me that he could be behind all this, not him personally, but some organized group that he, I surmise, was most likely affiliated with since the day I met him. But I finally put all the pieces together probably about 6 months ago. Just realized that, especially going through my storage unit, that, oh my goodness, the items that are missing in my storage unit were also gifts. So it was just like, you know, a huge wake-up call.
I bet. We're talking 12 years ago and then the five-year span of constant covert harassment and microwave attacks. But there was another clue, and that was your phone being stolen and then the potential cloning of your phone, which I really don't know much about. Would you talk more about that for listeners?
Yeah, it was probably about 14 months ago. I lived in an apartment before the house I live in Virginia right now, that I had my iPhone stolen actually 3 times. The first time I woke up, I had fallen asleep. It was always on my bed or a nightstand or whatever, charging, and it was literally just gone. It had just disappeared. So I purchased another one and probably had that for a few months. And that one disappeared. I should say stolen, the same type of circumstances. That one actually, though, suddenly appeared on my kitchen counter, you know, after it had been stolen for a few weeks. And I could never make sense of anything because sometimes, you know, things would be stolen and then they were returned the next morning or within a few weeks. And I was always so physically sick from microwave attacks or poisoning or whatever that, you know, I was always behind the eight ball, so to speak, so much. And it was so hard for me to be proactive and try and figure out what in the heck was going on. But probably almost a year ago, I was looking for like an old contact number. And I was going through past cell phone records, and I kept noticing that almost every month, like clockwork, there was a call made to my ex's cell phone number for usually just 1 minute, sometimes, you know, longer, or sometimes a couple times a month. And I remember thinking, that is very odd, because I haven't spoken to him in probably 4 years. Yet there were these calls to him. So I started doing research, you know, putting all the pieces together. Well, my phone has been stolen, and there are calls to him, and actually calls to other numbers, because I did a lot of research that I don't even recognize, but I don't have the wherewithal to pursue all that. But I started doing research online, and, you know, in being in the telecommunications business for 15 years, I knew it was possible that a physical phone can be cloned, so to speak, if that phone is stolen and, you know, they have sort of an identical phone. And, you know, it gets very technical beyond that, that, you know, I don't understand all that. And the ability to do that is very, very professional. It would require a lot of expertise, you know, based on the research I wrote, but it can be done. So I believe that all of my, you know, texts, emails, phone calls, you know, are constantly monitored, heard, because there's an identical phone out there, you know, duplicating everything that I'm doing. And especially if these people don't want to be traced, it makes sense that they're going to call, you know, the person in charge, so to speak, my ex, and give updates or whatever, and there's no trace of communication. I mean, obviously, I can't prove that I didn't make those calls. That's not proof in and of itself. However, I know I didn't, because I haven't spoken to him in 4 years.
Yeah, I'm trying to understand the motivation or how it would help a organized covert stalking group to clone a target's phone. Why would they want to do that? How would it help? What are your thoughts on that?
I believe that's the most ingenious way to spy or monitor, you know, a target. They're always going to be one step ahead of the target. Say, oh, I plan on meeting this person for lunch. They already know I'm going to be gone at this certain time. It kind of alleviates the so-called need, in a way, for maybe cameras or, you know, the surveillance equipment. You know, if they have your communication device duplicated, so to speak, they're going to be aware of your every move, your conversation, your thoughts and feelings. And it seems to me that's the ultimate way to, you know, spy and stalk on someone.
Were you conscious of that level of surveillance, and would you avoid using that phone in certain cases where you knew that, well, if I say anything here and go to this location, they're going to know, so I won't use it?
You know, I actually did for a while. I purchased a burner phone right before I relocated about 6 months ago from Arizona to Virginia, where I live now, because I didn't want them, in quotes, to know I was moving and the address and all that. And I thought, you know, I had gotten away free, so to speak, but I was not successful, even when I used that burner phone. And I don't know, you know, how or why or what equipment they might have used to actually track me. It could have been maybe I did an internet search on the address, you know, that I live at now, or maybe there was surveillance equipment in the apartment that I lived in, and they heard my conversations through a recording device or whatever. I'm just guessing. I still use this phone now, and I know it's being monitored, but I really don't have anything to hide at this point. I'm, you know, here for a while. Beyond that, I'm not really sure. My stalking was just, you know, to that level, like monitoring every conversation or email or text and stealing or moving items and things like that, trying to make me look crazy or, you know, make the actual person think they were going crazy. That would be, let's see, manageable, I believe. But now with the electronic harassment, those things are very minor to me. Now I am physically assaulted pretty much 24/7, and it's extremely difficult to live you know, day by day and just get even the most minor of tasks done. It's a life, but it's not a life. You're merely existing or surviving. You know, you're not thriving or looking forward to future events. You're just in survival mode. How am I going to get through this day, manage to eat or take a shower or, you know, anything like that, because I feel so physically horrible, you know. Either my whole body feels electrified, or, you know, my face has been burned. I'm paralyzed a little bit for a while. It's just, it's endless.
I think it's difficult for listeners to understand what that actually might feel like. Most people listening maybe have not been electrocuted or have been in the path of dangerous microwave energy and feel their actual teeth begin to hurt, things like that. How would you describe a typical attack? What would it do to you?
You know, basically, the best way I describe it to people who have not experienced it is you feel like you have the flu times 100 with, you know, just extreme weariness, fatigue, and that those words are not even adequate, but you can hardly move. You just feel like you've been run over by a truck. It can be anywhere from your whole body aching, you know, your muscles, your joints, everything, extreme headaches, double vision, kind of like a feeling like your ears are going to explode. A lot of times there's high-pitched ringing to varying degrees. It really never goes away for some of us, me included now. Just difficult to even, you know, get up from a sitting position. You just absolutely have no energy because your body has just, you know, been drained by these assaults all the time.
Susan, thank you for describing that for listeners. And you mentioned the other dangerous element involved here is being drugged or poisoned. And this commonly is described by those being stalked and is exactly what Dr. John Hall wrote about in his book, A New Breed, Satellite Terrorism in America. Would you please talk about the two encounters you had recalled when we talked earlier involving actually seeing people in the house in Arizona?
Yes. Both occurrences, they happened in one particular apartment. It wasn't this past December, but the December before last, the month of hell, actually. One evening, I woke up around 11 p.m., and I recall sort of, you know, stumbling out from my bedroom to the kitchen and seeing a group of people, maybe five or six, men and women. And I remember saying, "What are you guys doing here?" And that is actually the last thing that I remember. And, you know, nothing after that. But for some reason, that has absolutely stuck in my mind for a lot, you know, forever. You know, it's been a couple years now. People might think, well, how do I know I wasn't dreaming or, you know, sleepwalking, hallucinating? I just know. It's just, it's a memory, you know. It was committed to my long-term memory, and that's that. And whatever drug or method they use to, you know, knock me back out, highly effective. Nothing, you know, your short-term memory, maybe whatever subsequently happened, you are not conscious enough for it to commit to long-term memory.
Before you go to the second example, I just want to touch on that first one for a minute. If you could just freeze the image and describe the room and where the people were located in the room, and if you could, maybe a description of them, what you recall?
They were standing in my kitchen. There's a kitchen island, and I remember the group of them, they were kind of like in a circle, you know, around that kitchen island, men and women, but I don't recall, I have no memory of, you know, faces or maybe, you know, age range or anything like that, unfortunately. I hope to, you know, maybe revisit that and retain some memory of that, because that would just be very helpful for me.
And that was your last memory before, did you turn around and walk back to bed?
I honestly do not know. I don't remember anything after that. You know, I don't remember if I passed out there or I stumbled back to bed or maybe a couple of them came over and dragged me back to the bedroom. I do not know. I mean, everything is wiped out after, you know, seeing them and saying, what are you doing there? And to me, my words kind of indicate, and perhaps I knew one or two of them. Like, I don't know why I didn't scream. I don't remember being panicked or anything like that. It was just like, what are you doing here? Like, I knew someone, if that makes sense. I don't know if I'm interpreting that correctly, but that's just my impression.
Yeah, I can understand that. Maybe you recognize someone. It's like, hey, what are you doing here?
Yes, yes.
All right, this second one is very chilling. Please describe that.
I remember waking up early one morning. I don't know, gosh, it was anywhere from 5 to 6 a.m. Daylight was just coming up, and I looked over to the side where I had a couple of windows in my bedroom, and I recall seeing a man standing there, but his back was faced towards me. There was no face. He was looking out the window, drinking a bottle of water, and then I sort of glanced over at my nightstand, and I recall seeing a full bottle of water placed there, and I remember thinking, how did that get there? Because I had had a can of Coke there the night before that I had left. So this person obviously replaced my Coke with water, most likely wanted me to drink after whatever had happened that night. But I don't remember anything after that. I just fell back asleep after seeing, you know, this man with his back turned and then the water, and then I just fell right back to sleep. And that is etched clearly too. It's not a, you know, hallucination or a dream or anything like that.
Do you recall what this individual might be wearing?
I do not, unfortunately. I vaguely recall sandy blonde hair, but that's pretty much it.
So I think listeners are getting an idea of the potential for you to be poisoned or drugged and kept in some state of sedation. Because if people aren't able to get into your apartment and home without you really knowing it and doing whatever they want, I mean, who knows what was set up in your home? Cameras, surveillance systems, quite a vulnerable
Correct.
Situation, yes.
Correct. Quite terrifying. So many things have happened to me. It's very difficult for me to process, you know, each one, because, you know, each event keeps happening, and it's just, if it ever does stop for me, it's going to take a lot for me to recover as much as I can from this. It's just, right now, I'm in flight or fight mode right now, and that's all I can do.
I might suggest that you're more of an empathic type of person, and we've examined the psychopathic condition in depth back in 2011 on the show, and specifically the book titled Political Ponderology. And it was noted that psychopaths are drawn to empathic people. And you did mention a few traits of your ex-fiancé that are typical psychopathic traits, such as having a temper, but also pathological lying, lack of guilt, superficial charm, and that list goes on. I think there are about 20 20 things on that list.
Yes, lack of empathy, yeah, is a very big one as well. Almost as if they're disconnected from humanity in a way, you know, compassion, empathy, feeling, things like that.
Did you confront your ex-fiancé about the missing items and odd occurrences?
You know, I did in a way via text. I did try to call him. I actually did call him last March a couple of times. He never would answer the phone, actually, even prior to the 4 years. You know, when we were talking, he would never answer the phone when I called. Eventually, he may or may not call me back. So I knew a conversation with him was futile. And I sent a few texts his way, and he of course, denied it. But I knew, I mean, I know it's him. You know, I have enough things that he said, items that were taken, my phone record, and basically my gut. I mean, everything points to him. And all of the odd events, scenarios, you know, over the years, or things said that didn't quite make sense, you know, in and of themselves, isolated, it all comes together now. And that is the horrifying part. You realize you've known a monster, and I don't know what to do about it, because it's not just him. It's organized stalking as well, and he's operating by proxy. He's not directly involved in all these horrendous assaults and everything like that. So,
well, you're doing the right thing by making it public, and I think that's important. There were a couple things that you mentioned regarding waking up as if from a drugged state. In one situation, it was as if you were propped up in your bed, and in another, you had woken up disrobed and partially under your bed. Would you tell listeners about that?
Yes. The one instance where I woke up and I had no clothes on. I woke up, it was probably, oh gosh, early afternoon, 1 or 2 p.m., and I was half under my bed, and I remember kind of looking around, feeling incredibly groggy, and I actually, for a while, an hour or two, I did not know where I was. I remember looking around the apartment and the furnishings, and I had this thought that I'm not supposed to live here. I think I had moved from that place, which didn't make sense to me. And I remember being scared, actually, that whoever lived there now was going to come home. I mean, I had been so drugged or whatever happened to me, I literally did not know where I was or where I should be. And, of course, I didn't have any clothes on. And I laid on the floor there, actually, until it started to turn dark. I recall my phone ringing later that afternoon when I was still laying there, and it was my sister calling, and I couldn't even move to answer that. You know, I was like paralyzed in a way. It's just everything was slow motion. I was very groggy, so I just laid there. And then when I was actually able to move and find the phone, I called her, and she lives in Florida, but she called my mom then, who lives in Arizona. And eventually my mom came over, and I told, you know, the story, and it really was treated like nothing was wrong, you know. It's hard for people to believe that, I guess, these horrible bad things can happen to a family member when there's really, you know, no evidence, so to speak. Of course, I had put clothes on and things like that. You know, if there's no sign of a break-in and, you know, this and that, then no one really believes, to be honest with you, or no sign of, you know, physical assault, like a bruise or, you know, a knife wound, things like that. So that was that instance. Clearly, I had been given too much of whatever drug or whatever, and no, I assume I could have easily died or just lost some kind of brain capacity, because that is absolutely horrifying to wake up and not know where you are and no clothes. And people might think, well, why don't you call the police? Well, the police don't believe either, really. I had called them twice in the past, and, you know, because I knew someone was in there breaking in once. I saw the deadbolt turning, but by the time they get there, there's no one there, and then they think, oh, you know, this person is just crazy or delusional. So, you know, you reach a point where you don't trust the authorities either, because they're going to assume that perhaps you have a mental illness, and it'll go in the absolute wrong direction that it needs to go in for help.
Yeah, I wonder if Rufinol is involved in any of this.
It's possible. Propranolol comes to mind, and then there's another medication, both, you know, used in anesthesiology for surgery and all that. But, you know, you don't have a memory when you come to, like maybe events prior to right when you went under and when you awaken. You could be chattering away, as is the case a lot with the twilight sedation, propranolol, and you don't have a memory of it. So I think of things like that as well, but who knows?
You don't have a memory, but sometimes you have physical marks on your body. Can you talk about that?
Oh, from time to time, I would wake up and notice I had bruises on my thighs quite frequently, a couple times a week, or bruises on my arms, like little cut marks, you know, sometimes on my torso or my arms, you know, almost like you cut yourself with a knife or, you know, something like that, like by accident. But they were also very superficial. You know, you think, well, maybe I got scratched by a branch, or, you know, one of my pet's claws got me by accident and I just don't remember. You dismiss those things as maybe, you know, nothing, because nothing's like horrendous. You don't need stitches or anything. But the bruises never made sense, but I never could explain them. Well, maybe I just run into something and I didn't feel it. But now it all makes sense. I actually have had bruises on my stomach as well, too, when I wake up. But it's not, those aren't really issues that you can go to the police and say, hey, I woke up with a couple bruises, or I just noticed these couple bruises the other day. It's just, you know, it's really nothing to go on.
Susan, how is your health right now? What is your daily life like?
My daily life is a struggle. It's day by day. I am terrified of going to sleep at night, because I am just hit by whatever electronic weapon it is or frequency, where I have horrendous nightmares, very vivid, all night long. I wake up every 1 to 2 hours every night just terrified from these nightmares. My heart's racing. I'm either shivering to death or I'm drenched in sweat. I'll go back to sleep and then, you know, wake up again the next 1 to 2 hours. So by the time it's morning, I am just exhausted. I just feel horrible. I can barely walk some days, you know, from the muscle pain, the joint pain. Sometimes my bones hurt, which sounds odd to say, but it's like you can, especially my hips, I can feel them aching. My body retains fluid now from the attacks. My knees swell, my ankles, feet, wrists, hands, and it's hard for me to walk normal or navigate from all that fluid retention. I get tremendous headaches, double vision, can become very dizzy, nauseous, a lot of digestive issues. It's the whole gamut of systemic symptoms.
Let's hear part of an interview with Dr. John Hall, an anesthesiologist who studied and researched organized stalking for years. This interview is from April 2010. Let's have a listen.
The girl I wrote about in the book, this was a sexual assault case. I had her home broken into. There was Rohypnol placed in bottled water in her refrigerator. And then she was repeatedly raped while drugged with Rohypnol. So once we identified the perpetrators, we started checking it out, investigating it ourselves, and found that these people are sitting at a computer and doing this from a laptop most of the time in their home, at least the people accessing the technology. Now, the stalking, at least in the case here and other cases that I've looked into, are being done usually just by hired thugs, hired criminals that are in the community. Those are the people they have breaking into your home, moving things around, usually not stealing anything, but just breaking in as part of a psychological operation to put you in a victim mentality, to let the victim know that their home is going to be broken into and that there's nothing they can do about it. That's all part of the entire constellation of symptoms that you get with this type of attack. But as far as the delivery of the attack, it is person-specific. They can twitch certain muscle groups using ultrasonic energy. They can burn certain areas on the skin. Most people will complain about headaches, especially at the back of the head. And what I mean by anatomically correct attacks, by looking at an X-ray image, they can see where bony protuberances are, like the occiput of the skull or the back of the skull sits very close under the skin, and there's several nerve fibers that come out from underneath the skull. The back of the head is a very popular target in victims that are being attacked, because when you attack that area, you're also attacking the nerves that are very superficial, and it'll cause a real severe headache that comes from the back of the skull and along the upper part of the back of the scalp. Almost all of the victims complain of that.
What kind of beam did you say that was?
Usually they're using microwave or ultrasound to do that. Now, the other weapon that's on the platform, that, as it was explained to me, is particle beam. Particle beam is either a proton or a neutrino beam that actually liberates radiation when it strikes. As the CIA agent explained to me, that you would know if you were being hit by that because it's very painful and can actually do damage. Now, most of the other modalities, the weapons on the platform, are what they describe as non-lethal weaponry. It's going to hurt while it's being used on you, but then the pain will subside when they stop, and it usually doesn't leave any indication of being perpetrated on you. But particle beam actually will cause bleeding, cause burning, cause marks on the skin, depending on where you're attacked, and if you're attacked in the chest, can cause you to cough up blood. Could be fatal if it's used at a high output.
Is the particle beams, the ultrasound beams, coming from a satellite?
Well, according to my source, it is loaded on a satellite weapons platform. Now, I know there are other people that have websites on this kind of harassment that believe that this is all being done with ground-based weaponry, which has led a lot of the victims to suspect their neighbors. At least in my research and victims I've talked to, I haven't found that to be true. In Texas especially, that's really easy to evaluate because a lot of the victims in the state of Texas live in wide open areas. You know, we have a lot of property in Texas. Most of us aren't living in congested urban areas. We've actually taken victims that are experiencing these kind of attacks in apartment settings and taken them out to, 6,000 and 7,000 acre ranches in West Texas where there's no cell phone coverage, where there's no power lines, where there's no electricity of any type, and they still hear the voices and they still get attacked. If you use common sense and you look at the way these people are victimized everywhere they go, there's almost no other technology out there that can track you, from state to state, even in areas where there's little to no electricity, and still make you hear voices and still attack you with directed energy.
That was part of an interview with Dr. John Hall explaining some details of how people can be targeted by microwave and sonic weapons. He also mentioned the tactic of covertly drugging people. Susan, I really appreciate you going into detail here and describing very disturbing instances and occurrences of covert harassment and stalking. I do think, you know, by sharing your story, it will empower your situation and others. Is there anything that you would want to tell listeners about what you're going through and how it might help others?
I would like listeners, if they know of a friend or an acquaintance or heard of a story via online news, whatever, to just not automatically dismiss, you know, what they're hearing as not believable or crazy or that can't happen, it doesn't exist. We desperately need people to at least hear us and start to believe, you know, what's going on, as absurd or as insane as it sounds, because we're all dying out there. I mean, if we don't die immediately, it is a slow and painful death. And eventually, if it's not a heart attack or a stroke, it'll be some rare cancer or just some degenerative disease from all of the energy attacks. So we just want to be heard at this point and gain public awareness.
Susan, if listeners want to reach out and get in touch with you, what is the best way to do that?
They can reach me via email. It's felinegirl, F-E-L-I-N-E, a girl with three L's, G-I-R-L-L-L, @gmail.com.
Well, Susan Conling, thank you so much for sharing your story and being on In Other News.
Thank you so much, Jeff.
That's going to do it for In Other News. I'm Jeff Brady. Visit inothernewsradio.com for archives and more information about the guests.